Oh, yeah.
We ended up taking up the whole office.
Yeah, it was a bunch of guys.
Yeah, it was a blast, man. It was like, I had an office, and then my office was a closet.
Hey, this is Forrest with the Concrete Conversations podcast. We had an episode today with Mo Abbas. Mo is a really friendly guy from Canada. We love our Canadians on this show. And Mo had a lot to say today about sales, about networking, and about how to manage employees, both sales employees and non, how to step away from your business. If you've got a business that you've started, or if you're wanting to get into that and into some entrepreneurship, and you want to get it to a point where you can step back and have it keep running and doing that well, Mo has a lot of experience with that, and we touch on that quite a bit here in the episode. You're going to love it. Wanted to jump into this question first about something that's on your LinkedIn profile and something we had spoken, you and I, about previously, which is your that first company you started when you were very young, a design-build residential company. Now, in any industry, there are all these terms that can sometimes feel a little esoteric, a little odd. That term design build, there's design build, design bid build. Help us understand. Anybody will understand what a residential construction company is. What's specific about a design build company that that maybe somebody new in construction might not clue into right away?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess one way to look at it is the way the value stack is organized. And you have on the bottom of the stack, which is the bulk of the work is done by trades. That could be an electrician, a plumber, flooring installer, doors and windows. And they're organized by typically a general contractor who organizes the trades in a project. Okay. And then what sits on top of a general contractor is usually the design, the architect, which would then give instructions to the general contractor, which would then give instructions to the actual sub-trades that are on the project, who give then instructions to the actual workers, right? So that's kind of how the hierarchy works. When you're a design builder, you occupy both the design element of the project and the general contracting element of the project as well. So you do the design and general contracting as a design and builder.
And so how does that differ from design bid build?
I think those are probably identical to each other. I don't think there's a massive difference. It's probably in the bid process might be slightly different between the two.
Right. Yeah. So, and these are, anytime that I'm having guests on, we've got some esoteric terms and really non-intuitive terms. We like to try and just kind of define those in the beginning. As I've had conversations with a lot of ground penetrating radar folks, which is kind of my primary industry, we have to define a lot of terms.
Now, I was just going to say, I was reading a quote by Elon Musk where in his organization, SpaceX, he doesn't even allow acronyms. Like, because everyone tries to sound smarter by throwing acronyms out there, right? So the simplest terminology is usually the best terminology.
Well, and who said that? Was it Einstein who said that if you don't know a topic well enough to explain it to a five-year-old, then you don't know a topic well enough, or something to that effect? You have to be able to take a complex topic and really learn how to distill that down to its most basic components, depending upon your audience.
David Ogilvy, the same thing. He's the greatest advertiser of all time, biggest advertising company ever created. And his whole notion was he didn't even hire educated people. He's like, if you have a college university degree, you're not going to be a good advertiser because you're going to make the language too complex. So he liked very simple layman terms that everybody can understand.
Yeah, I love that. That's actually kind of most of my background is in sales. And then I've learned ground penetrating radar and this kind of this industry that I'm in right now. But I've always had, and I suppose always will have, a passion for sales because I love this idea of how to of communicating with somebody about a shared topic and trying to figure out if this service is a good fit. And it's an interesting process, and I've always loved that. And the ability to walk into a room and take the temperature of the room, figure out what this group of people needs to hear, what kind of language, what kind of examples, what kind of mannerisms they need to see and feel and hear in order for them to make a buying decision. I love that. And it's obviously crucial, I think, for any good salesman to have.
There's a lot to that, man. That could be a whole podcast by itself, to be honest. Like, sales is not, it can go really, you can go deep, deep, deep on sales.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we had an episode a little while back with one of my old sales managers, Matt Dragon, and he's the best sales manager that I've ever had. He did a fantastic job and really exemplified a lot of the things that I had always heard about in my sales trainings and read in sales and management books, and he just almost perfectly exemplified. And it was a pleasure to work with a guy who's just a consummate sales professional, and they really stand out in a company. When you have somebody trained in sales, it's such a big difference in my mind.
I mean, I completely agree with you. I've seen really great, awesome salespeople and terrible ones, and there's an order of magnitude difference between them. And it is, you know, it is a learned trait, you know, and it's funny, it's hard to even pin it. Like, I've seen people who are like super smooth and suave, but they can't sell because they can't ask for the close. And I've seen other people who don't have any kind of, they're just direct. They're just like, hey, do you want to buy this? And then their sales are way higher. So there's no exact formula. There's no exact style, let me say, actually. The formula is kind of similar, but the style varies greatly.
Yeah. And it is a really interesting fact. The first sales manager I ever had, he was the first one to kind of teach this to me, that it was a very, very small, very new company. I was one of two salespeople, and the other guy had a very different style to me. And I thought, my perception as a very inexperienced early 20-something, I thought his style was wrong. I thought the way that he was going about this was wrong. And I had to have this trained out of me that, like, no, that my sales manager was explaining, no, it's just different. And he's going to be able to close with customers that you won't, and vice versa. And as long as you're both getting that sale at the end of the day, there's a lot less concern over the method that's taken. There are a number of different styles, but they all kind of fit into one general category, or not one general category, kind of broad picture that always includes, as you pointed out, asking for the sale, which seems to be such a difficult thing for many people to do.
I mean, that's obviously, you need to do that, and it frustrates me when sales reps don't do that. I'm like, no wonder, how could you expect them to buy when you didn't ask if they wanted to buy, right? So that's a key component. I mean, if you look at the process for sales, typically it starts with building trust, right? You have to connect before you can communicate. If you don't have that connection, you cannot communicate. And then you have to establish need, right? You got to be like, well, what problem are you looking to solve? What are you looking to gain out of this, right? Then you really have to understand the client's perspective. Quite often I've seen sales reps, they jump into a pitch and I'm like, why are you pitching the product when you don't even know what the person's needs are? Like, you haven't figured out what they're looking for. So why are you speaking? You need to be listening. Most of sales is listening and then really just getting the person to come up with the answer themselves. That's my favorite type, where you're just asking questions and all of a sudden they're like, I need your service. I was like, oh, well, lucky I'm here. I can help you with that, right?
Yeah.
There is a way you could get people to act, especially when you know the process and the product inside and out, and you know typically what responses they're going to give. You could plan ahead. It is a chess game, frankly, and you have a tremendous advantage because you're playing this game every day. You know, like the client on the other side, they're playing it one time. So if you're a real master, you can study the game and you could win quite often if the game is winnable. Some games are not winnable, or you really shouldn't be selling some people. You know, I've had this problem in the past where I just took it too seriously. I just wanted to sell everyone, even if they weren't a good fit. And I was able to do that, right? But that causes problems later on. And I kind of stepped away from that. You know, if I believe there's a good value opportunity for them, then I will sell that person. I will show the value and we will work together. And if I don't, I'll guide them. Like, I don't think this is right, but maybe this other thing might work for you. So I personally like to approach it from solutions where, look, I'm like a consultant to you right now, and it may be my product, it may be another thing. If it's my product, great. If not, we're going to walk away with some kind of value from this meeting, right? So that's what I find works for me.
Yeah, I think that a consultative sales approach has a lot of value for everybody in the in that relationship, in that room. It has value for the sales professional because you don't feel quite so much pressure to just, you have got to sell that widget, you've got to sell that service, and if you don't, you're an absolute failure. No, look, you can still, if you go into the meeting or if you come out of the meeting understanding that your widget is not exactly right for the situation, you can still win in that scenario by gaining a relationship with this hopefully prospective customer in the future once they're ready to buy your widget. And it's a win for the customer too, because you know, they've got somebody who knows the industry inside and out, like you do, as you should, and you're able to point them in the direction that will help them right now. And in 6 months or 6 years, they're going to come back and say, I need to work with you. I need this widget. I don't want to work with anybody else but a guy like you.
Oftentimes, what I found is it's not as simple as a widget. Like when somebody's like, I want to renovate my kitchen, right? Like that is such an open statement, right? And you're not selling them something that's like, I have a thing, let's put it in here, and then that's the sale. It's more like, okay, cool, why are you doing this? You know, what kind of budget do you have? You know, let's look at your neighborhood and see what's the maximum value you can put into the house and get a return. Do you care about a return? Is this like a short-term or a long-term thing for you? You know, do you cook often? So it's not just like, tell me what you're looking for, here's your estimate. It's really understanding the why of things. And especially with high-ticket sales, which almost all construction is high-ticket sales, you're not selling a blank, like one little specific thing. It's usually a package that is complex and it's a solution. And then you have to be competent enough to define what that is for the client. They don't know. They want a kitchen. They want a better life. They don't know exactly what they want. And a really good salesperson helps the client crystallize their vision by asking the right questions, by having the knowledge to fill in the gaps for the client. And then the client walks away with a vision of what they want, an idea of the value, and they trust you because you've walked them through that. And then the next step is a lot easier that way.
So where did you learn sales or entrepreneurship or hustle? Is this something you learned at home from your parents, the next door neighbor? Just, it was all already in your head?
That's a great question. My parents were uneducated immigrants, and they did not teach me sales for sure, entrepreneurship. They didn't know anything. My dad was a tiler, actually. He's a tradesman. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. So I barely saw my dad. He was working all the time. And my mom, there was five of us. I barely saw her. I mean, I saw her at the house, but she was always busy with, you know, five kids running around. And we were extremely low income. We lived in subsidized government housing. So we lived on the good graces of the government, which we really appreciated. And, you know, when you live in that environment, typically you have a lot of freedom because nobody's watching you. Right, and you live poor. You know, I had freedom when I was poor, so I don't know where this came from. I always believed that I was destined for great things from a young age. Okay, and I was very, very curious. So, you know, I as a young, you know, 12-year-old boy would go door to door and sell whether chocolates or services. And I was really good at that. I actually was great at let me get out, have fun, and make money. I never got to keep any of the money, which kind of sucked. My mom always took the money for the family. But that was like my first taste of like, yeah, I couldn't even buy a chocolate bar for like a dollar. And to make like $50 in a day was an incredible amount of money to me back then. And that's when I kind of started falling in love with sales. It was like, wow, I can just go talk to people and they would give me money. This is really, really cool. So as a 12-year-old, I got pretty good at going door to door and I had the freedom to do that. So I did that for a while, but really, you know, and then obviously I did some retail sales later on. I worked at a women's clothing shop when I was probably around, I think it was 16 or 17 at that time. And the only reason I took that job was because it paid commissions. It was a pure commissions job. And I remember having conversations with these ladies, and, you know, I was a good looking guy and just giving them the compliments, making them feel good, telling them how amazing they looked and stacking those commissions, right? I love being rewarded for my work, not for the hours that I put in, but for the results that I generated based on effort and results. You know, that was something that all great salespeople will opt for commission. If you're a great salesperson, you want to stack your commissions because you know it's something you can influence. Whereas, you know, some decent salespeople, and they're like, yeah, I'm really concerned about the base and the commission is like, you know, I don't really know what I could sell. So that, you know, I was the opposite. I was like, give me commission only. Like that's all I want because I could work how many hours that I want and I could work, you know, to and generate results myself. So that's what I did. And my real, that kind of all accumulated into my first business, which was a landscaping company actually. And I was 18 at this time. And I had done a bit of traveling. I got lucky. I sold myself that, you know, talk about sales. Maybe I'll tell this story. So I was driving one day and I saw a friend in a parking lot. And I barely knew this guy. And he's like, hey, Mo, you know, I'm helping recruit talent for this contract work out in BC and eventually in Miami, Florida. I think you should go apply. I'm like, you know, I don't know anything. You had to fix phone lines. There was a big strike happening. I'm like, I don't know anything about fixing phone lines. And I'm 17 years old. I was just turning 18. And you had to be 18. So I just made that cusp. And I go to the interview and I don't know anything, to be honest. But I was able to sell myself. And then they gave me the job. And I went from making $15 an hour to that next, as soon as I got hired, now I'm making $30 an hour. I doubled my income in one day. Because I was able to sell myself. And that was really incredible. And frankly, I had no idea about phone lines. But what I would do is I would go visit these clients and I would just have a conversation with them, like a sales conversation. I'd make them feel good, talk about their day, you know, pretend I was fixing a phone line, which I had no idea what I was doing. And they loved me. I didn't fix their phone line, but they loved me, you know? That was a great experience. So I came back to Ottawa, which was my hometown. And, you know, I ended up in this landscaping company where we would go door to door repairing lawns and in the spring and driveways in the summer. And that's my real entrance into business because I went from being a salesperson. I started off as a salesperson there. I myself would personally go to each house, knock on the door, do the pitch, and do the work. If you know the four quadrants of income, okay, the first one is you are an employee. So when I worked in retail, I was an employee. Okay, you're not going to make a lot of money as an employee unless you're an MBA all-star. Okay, you're like a doctor, PhD, then you kind of make a little bit of money that way. Okay? The second way you make money is if you're self-employed. So now I became self-employed where I would go door to door and I would earn all of the money that I generated, not just a specific cut of the money that I generated. Big difference, right? Because you want to climb up the wealth ladder. When, you know, growing up poor, I know what it's like to not get what you want with something as basic as meat, right? Meat was rationed in my household. You couldn't just eat whatever you wanted. You could eat as much Fruit Loops as you wanted, but you can eat as much meat as you wanted because there's a really big price difference per calorie between the two, right? So I always, you know, had this drive. And I saw my mom get treated poorly and my family get treated poorly. And I was treated as like a lower class citizen. And I hated it because I believed that I was as good as anyone else. And what really opened my eyes to that was when I was in Miami, Florida, fixing these phone lines, I got lucky because I got to go into, you know, $50 million houses and meet these homeowners and have conversations with these homeowners. And these were normal people. They weren't just normal people. They wanted me. They wanted my youthful energy. I was what they wanted. I was what they were seeking. And I was like, whoa, you have all this wealth and you want my youth? You want my energy? You want me? Huh, you're like a normal person. You're not like any different than me. I could be like you. And that was really a big difference, was the realization that I can be wealthy, that it's not some sort of unattainable thing for people that are outside of my, you know, outside of my reach. And that really opened my eyes. So what did I do at that point? I came back to Ottawa, started this landscaping company in the spring and the summer, going door to door, and I became self-employed. I organized crews. So I started hiring people, and then I started giving them commissions, and I started shifting my way towards a business owner. But I was never really a business owner because I was the business. So if you're the business, you are self-employed. You're only a business owner when you are not the business. The business is the business. Very, very, very hard thing to get to. There's a big chasm between the two. It's a lot easier to go from employed to self-employed than to go from self-employed to business owner. It's a bigger jump between the two, okay? So that was my spring and my summer. And I started organizing people and, you know, setting up crews and routes, and I was making more money that way. I was now making $500 a day, cash, and staying fit. I looked good back then. I mean, I still look really good, but I was super fit. So what I would do in the off season, in the winter, when, you know, we didn't have the work, I did this for two seasons, okay, that whole landscaping thing. I was always a big reader, almost like obsessively so. But I would read like fiction books. And then when I came back from Miami and I had the epiphany that I can be wealthy, I said, okay, well, what does it take to be wealthy? What is the process? What is wealth? Started asking these questions that are important questions to ask yourself. And I started seeking the answer. So I go to the bookstore every day. And from morning till evening, I would sit and I would read. That was my life. Every single day. Reading and working out. Okay? Stop seeing my friends. Just would go read and work out. Those are actually my favorite time of my life, frankly. I learned so much. Like, you know, it was such a big learning curve. There was a time where I would go to the bookstore, and on every nonfiction shelf, I had read a book. I'm like, okay, I read that book. So I read that. So I knew a lot. I started off in business and psychology, self-help, and then I moved on to physics and, you know, things that are kind of just kind of satisfied my curiosity. And that was my education. I'm a high school dropout. Okay, I didn't even finish high school, right? I just wasn't really interested. I would see teachers. I'm like, you don't know. What are you trying to teach me that you don't even know? Why is my knowledge limited to your knowledge and you don't know? Okay, so I don't believe in most education. Now look, don't get me wrong. If you can go to Stanford and you can learn under, you know, some of these great profs that are like absolutely legendary, you know, and learning maybe computer science or something like really specific, do that. If you're just going to think that a school is going to get you educated, no, you are limited to your abilities, not to what you're taught, okay? So I took my destiny in my hands, and I realized that my throttle is just my own belief and my ability to work, okay? I've always been a good worker. I shouldn't say that, actually. There was a one time where I was extremely lazy and was not a good worker. And my life changed during an incident where I always had this potential. And there was one incident that happened in high school that kind of unlocked a lot of that potential. And it involved a girl and involved getting just to give you out. So that was, yeah, it got me motivated in high school. So, you know, here I am. I got these landscaping companies. And I realized, I'm like, you know, I started learning a little bit about business. I'm like, this landscaping thing, like, where does it go? Like, where do I go from here? How do I become like these wealthy people that I met in Florida? You know, it wasn't going to get there. I said, this could not become a big business ever, that the market was too constrained. So I said, all right, how am I going to get out? I sold the companies to my competitor in a really interesting way. I didn't make a lot of money. I made a little bit of money, okay? But it was enough money to start another business. And it just happened to coincide with, this is how I got into construction, okay? I had a friend. He was a personal trainer. And he worked at this gym. And this gym was a frankly. It needed to be renovated. It was an old gym in a basement in a mall. He calls me up. He's like, Mo, you know, my manager, we're looking at renovating this gym. And I know your dad, you know, he does some renovation work, right? I'm like, yeah, but he's a tiler. He doesn't know how to do construction work. He's like, oh, you know, that's too bad. Like, do you know anybody else that could help? I'm like, yeah, maybe I could help. So I go and I visit this gym. And I meet the manager and I use my sales skills at that point because I have no idea about construction. Okay? Nothing. I knew nothing, man. I didn't know what gypsum was. Okay? Just to give you an idea. So I meet the manager. We didn't even talk about it. We talked about the project. It was more relationship building. And he's like, yeah, obviously he liked me because he wanted me to get the job. And he helped me actually get the contract. And I remember I was like looking at the plans and I'm like, yeah, and I'm looking at it and I'm just like, I'm just listening. I'm not saying a whole lot because I have no idea what's going on here. I'm just like, yeah, walking through, nodding my head, pointing. Oh, yeah, that's, yeah, yeah, that's, yeah, we can definitely do that. Yeah, 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 we'll take care of that, no problem, you know? Like a lot of yes. And, but, well, you know, little did I know back then that I was actually the one getting hustled because the owner of that gym, yeah, he knew that I didn't know what I was doing. I had severely underpriced the work. So I'm like, you know, like, okay, let me build an estimate for this. So I put together an estimate. It was severely underpriced. I didn't know this. He knew that. He's like, oh, you want to do the job? No problem. You can have the job, right? He didn't give me a deposit as well. So he's like, you go, here's the contract. Yeah, I'll sign your contract. Go ahead. Go start on the work. So here I was. Now I'm financing this project. And severely underpriced it. And now we got to do the work. So I'm like, oh, shit, what do I do now? I didn't know any tradesmen. I knew my dad. He's a tiler. He's a one-man shop, right? He came. He's like, I can't help you. I don't know anything about this. He didn't even help me in the project. I had my father-in-law had a little bit of experience with framing commercially. So I'm like, hey, can you come help me? So he comes and helps me. And I got some laborers and, man, it was so hard. It was so, so hard. I was there for almost 9 months on this project. And I wasn't getting paid. You know, I was financing this and I would submit invoices. And it's just not getting responses, getting delays. And I just thought like, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get paid. Like everyone pays, right? This is how the world works, especially in contracting. We have a contract here. That never happens in with contracts, you know. And, you know, it was so, so hard. I remember, you know, you got to understand, like, I don't know what I was doing. And I remember one time it was like 2 a.m. And I'm there by myself demolishing a wall that was fire sprayed with insulation. And it's like dusty and I could barely see. And I'm like breathing in this dust. And I know I'm taking years off my life. I know this, okay? And it's dark, and I have one floodlight, and there's nobody in this basement. It's like pitch black everywhere with one floodlight. It's dusty. I could barely see. I had just been bringing cinder blocks in all day. My hands are bleeding. You know, I'm like, what the f- am I doing here? I don't know what I'm doing here. You know, like, this is crazy. You know, that was a real eye-opener for me. The other one was, you know, I was engineering a floor, okay? Because there was no real plans. I had to build out this floor. I was literally engineering this floor. And I'm like, this is not going to turn out well. Now I'm like thinking in hindsight, I'm like, yeah, that definitely did not turn out well. You know, I was spanning the joists along the long length, you know, instead of the short, the long instead of the short. So it was just bad, 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 bad. Okay. I know why I didn't get paid, to be honest.
So did you ever get paid on that project at all?
I didn't get paid what I was owed. He gave me enough that I didn't file a lawsuit because I also didn't know how to do that. He paid me enough to be like, go away, go away. Here's like your less than your costs, but enough for you to walk away. And then I was like, oh,
half of the stuff that you've told me about this this project would not have been able to happen, like get off the ground in California. So you must have some very different inspections and things that you guys work under. This was in Ottawa?
This was in Ottawa. It was supposed to be mostly cosmetic, but it turned out to be a lot more than that.
I don't even know. Yeah. I mean, everybody who's been in construction, especially if you've started a company in somewhere in the AEC industry, architecture, engineering, and construction, if you've started a company in there, then in the beginning, any small business you start, you're hungry, especially if it's your first go around at starting a business. You are just hungry. You don't know what you don't know. You don't realize, you know, I'm going to lose my shirt if I do it at this price. And everybody's got some story or several stories of when they either lost their shirt on it or they took ridiculous risks. One of our other guests, we were doing, he's behind the Reality Capture Network. And he was telling us a story about when he was first doing one of his first laser scan jobs. And he was in this old abandoned mine, he and this other guy, and they were handing the laser scanner, the tripod and everything over rocks that had fallen from the roof and big wood beams saying danger on it. And don't go beyond this point. They didn't have supplemental oxygen. They didn't have hard hats. They didn't have any kind of safety, anything, but he was hungry. He needed to pay bills. And so he just did the job. In hindsight, he said, and I've said about similar jobs, like, okay, I would never do a job like that today. It's just not worth it. But a combination of ignorance and being really hungry, and I think, at least for me, part of it in the very beginning for me was just wanting to prove something to myself too. Like, okay, I can do this crazy job that I maybe feel very unqualified for, maybe some imposter syndrome, and maybe truly am not well qualified for, but let's give it a try. Let's see what we can do. And you make it through, you don't make it through, but you get up the next day and you try not to make a stupid mistake like that again.
You know, and that never goes away. Like, even when I started Sales Ask, it's the same kind of, you don't do the same kind of stupid risks, but it's a similar uncertainty where it's like, you start the company and then you just move forward. You don't really know what's going to happen or what's going to work, right? Like, I don't know, you know, if AI is going to be picked up by contractors. Now we do. Now we have a lot more, you know, you start selling clients and you have a lot more success and you can show the success and you iterate forward, right? But earlier on, you don't know ever. Even, you know, this deep in my career, whenever I start a new business, it's always an uncertainty. It's a similar kind of process as it was back then. But there's sacrifices you would make back then that you definitely would not make today. You don't even need to at this point because you have the experience. You have the knowledge. You don't need to make the same stupid mistakes. So that's my first construction project.
I hope that you didn't have a repeat of that any other time in your career. Was that a one and done?
The second one, I got unionized somehow, which was also weird the way that happened. I had hired a few subs, never met these people before. The one day, the first day they started as subcontractors on a trim project in a condo building, they signed union papers. Then I become unionized because of that. Right. And then I was like, how was this? I just met these people. They just were like, yeah, but they were dependent contractors. So my ignorance, you know, made me a union chop super early on, which kind of, you know, if you don't have experience, you can't really price commercial jobs the way against union. You know, you got to really, it's a whole other world, right? Especially for somebody who's just pure hustler. So at that point, I was like, screw this. I'm done with commercial construction. I'm going to go to residential construction because residential construction, you can just talk to a client. You can just have a conversation. It's easier to manage.
Let's remodel your kitchen.
Exactly. You know, let's talk about this. Let's figure it out. It's not what's your price, what's the scope, what's the plans. Don't talk to me. I come, I inspect, I pay you if it's done. It's very much about building relationships with your clients. Okay. And I was really good at that. So the sales was, it goes back to core competency. What's your core competency? If you're an awesome tradesman, you know your numbers, you're very analytical, you're very organized, methodical, maybe you can tender commercial projects out of the gate, right? If you're more like a salesperson and problem solver and, you know, probably want to go towards more residential at that point, right? So that's what I did. I started focusing on residential and I didn't have an office. I would meet clients at the Starbucks. Put up like on Craigslist kind of listing, and people would call me, and it was like, I got like some drywall that needs to be taped, a door that needs to be hung, some flooring that needs to be installed. And then your confidence goes up. You know, you ever heard of Dunning-Kruger effect?
Yes.
No. Okay. So Dunning-Kruger effect is when you start something new.
That's right.
There's a bell. Okay. You know it. When you start something new, your confidence is super high. As you know, so when I started a commercial project, I could do this. And I got into it, I was like, oh my God, I could not do anything in construction. It just goes down confidence as you gain a little bit of experience. And then it starts creeping up as you gain experience again. This is normal for anything new that you try. So now my experience, I was starting to get some experience and my confidence was going up again. And then I started, okay, you know what? Maybe I'll start pricing on some basements. And then maybe a little bit of bathrooms. And they were hard for me. I butchered a whole bunch of jobs. But they still liked me, and we still figured it out in the end. I always was able to figure it out with the clients. And then I ended up doing $1 million out of the Starbucks, okay, in sales. Myself, one-man show. Just the Starbucks, just me. I go meet clients at their home or at the coffee shop. And then just sell. That's it. And I remember like driving my little dinky truck with my trailer, going to Home Depot, picking up the stuff, putting it in, you know, and $1 million was a big deal. I'd walk away with 200K at that point, which was a big deal, even with my underpriced jobs. And then from there, I'm like, okay, I want to start building more of a business here. I leased a small little office. Nothing, I couldn't afford a whole lot. And I didn't even, you know, it was just one little office. It was in the basement of a dental clinic. And then I hired some of my friends. So I was really good at sales. And then I unlocked something that no other contractor was doing at the time. And this really gave me a huge advantage. This was one of my first breakthrough. And that was Google. No contractors were marketing on Google. No Google SEO, no Google ads, no Google anything, right? And I was like, I don't know, man. Like, people are probably searching on Google to find contracting help. So why don't we just dominate Google? Like, I'm very tech savvy. All these old contractors are super late to this game. And that's what I did. I started marketing on Google and I figured out lead gen. When you figure out lead gen, now you have the opportunity to sell. Okay, so I'm having a lot of leads come through. And talking to these clients. And I was selling them. And slowly, at that point, some of my friends were starting to graduate university and college. And I would start hiring them, right? These are all the people. I didn't go to school. They went to school. I was just getting work experience. And when they graduated, I'm like, okay, you guys come work for me. Come work for me. Come work for me. So I hired all of my friends that graduated out of college and university. And it was about a dozen of us at the time, man. It was not a small situation. We ended up taking up the whole office.
Yeah, it was a bunch of guys.
Yeah, it was a blast, man. It was like I had an office, and my office was a closet for most of the time we were there. I was literally in a closet or a hallway. That's where I was situated, you know. We ended up taking the whole basement floor, and then we got another breakthrough. And you gotta understand, like, this is me and these are like my boys. We grew up together, right? And then one's doing sales, one's doing project management. And like, it was a glorious time. And then I got another unlock. which was design. There was 3D designs that were just coming out at that time. And I saw my main competitor was doing this. Right? You really want to copy your competition. In construction, my first thing I'll say is, man, somebody's successful somewhere. What are they doing? Why are you not doing what they're doing? If they figured it out, what are you trying to do? Trying to reinvent construction? I mean, you can, like a part of it, not the whole thing. So somebody figured out the design and build element. And I was like, these guys are the number one guys and they're doing design and build. We should do something like that. So we started doing design and build. And again, I hired like a student at a school as an intern to draft some designs. And eventually I hired that person full time. And, you know, that's how I grew that segment of the company.
When was this about? I mean, approximate year?
This was about 15 years ago. Yeah, 15, 16 years ago.
Yeah, early 2000s. Okay.
Early 2000s. Yeah, correct. So we started doing design build. And I thought, I was like, all right, you know, we're trending, we're at 3 million now. We're going to 4 million. So my suggestion, like with, you know, right now we have a software that uses AI to analyze conversations between sales reps and clients. It's called Sales Ask.
Yeah, Sales Ask. It's cutting edge. Yeah, tell us about that.
Sales Ask. Yeah, it's a brand new cutting edge software. And what it does is it listens to conversations that sales reps have with clients. Okay. And it analyzes those conversations, it transcribes them, which allows sales managers or owners to get visibility into what sales reps are saying with clients in the field. Okay. That's the basic of it. But with that visibility, they could leave comments on the transcript. They can jump between topics. We're implementing a feature that'll score the meeting using AI to tell the sales manager how well they followed their sales process. We generate an AI summary. We generate AI action items. So we're bringing AI to the sales process in construction. Okay. This is the new thing. This is what every contractor is going to be doing in the next 2 to 3 years. Okay. This is what I was doing back then with Google and then with design. It was the new thing. We did it first, so we ate everything before everyone else got on board, and then they had their fair share at that point. Okay. It was such a big advantage. I wouldn't be here if without that advantage, I'll tell you that. You know, I remember having a conversation with my main competitor. He's like, I don't know. He's like, I've been in this business for 50 years. Okay. He's a generational company, massive, massive company. And he's like, nobody's done what you've done. Nobody's come and competed with us like you have. And the only reason we're able to do that is because we adapted the technology before anyone else. Okay. Even before they did. So we took on the design build. It gave us a big advantage. I thought I made it. I'm like, you know, I'm going to hire a GM. I'm going to go chill. We're doing about 3 million. We're like trending up. You know, it's all good. So I stepped back from the company for a bit. And that was a terrible idea. This business, I thought I had built the business. No, it was still owner operator. Okay. I stepped down, the business fails. That's just what it is in a lot of the trades businesses that we're in. They're very owner operator heavy. Okay. There is a certain point you can step away and I'll talk about that.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to see if we could get to. I'd love to get to where you see that line, that demarcation between owner operator and advancing beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I stepped away, we lost, we ran out of cash and we were getting crushed. So I'm like, man, we're like negative 200K. What are we going to do here? We're screwed. So one thing I'll give a tip to a lot of contractors, if you're not doing this already, you must do this. We shift this one thing, changed our cash position, kept us alive. We shifted the collection of money from the end of a milestone to the start of a milestone. Before it was like, when we're done electrical, you pay us. We changed it to when we start electrical, you pay us. Completely changes your cash flow. So now we became cash heavy because we're getting so many upfront payments. I'm like, well, why are we going to fund your project? You fund your own project. You give us the money, then we pay for things. Not we pay for things and then collect like commercial does, right? Game changer. So I started expanding the company across the nation to 4 different cities. You know, also was a bit premature. A lot of lessons there. I don't know if you want to jump in those lessons. But a lot of lessons learned. I shut down two of the cities, and the third one was actually very successful. Sold my equity in that. I'm actually rebuying that equity now. I'm buying the whole company now, back at like less than what I paid for it, which was good. But the real turning point, you know, there's two things you need to go from owner operator to a business owner. Okay, there's a few things that you need. One is people. You're just not going to get there without the people. You need a leader, one dominant figure. That's you, but when you want to step out, that's not you. That's someone else. That person is responsible for your P&L. They're responsible for this profit and loss statement. They're responsible for the hiring, for the firing, for they're going to sit on the board. It is not exactly a general manager. If it's a general manager, you got to be floating around, making sure that you're looking at the financials and taking care of everything still. Okay, you could still do that, but you're still in the business at that point. It's a CEO. The difference between a CEO and a GM is, with a GM, you're still in the business. With a CEO, you're just on the board, if it's somebody, a CEO that you trust, right? So that's one thing. It's the people. I didn't step away from my business until I had a management team in place, which took a freaking long time to build. Such a long time. And a CEO that I trusted that could lead the management team, that has already proven himself in that other company I mentioned in Vancouver, proved himself there, grew it to 5 million, came here, took it from 5 million to 20 million. Okay, so the person, and then the infrastructure, which includes the systems and processes. Okay, so you need to have a system that works. It doesn't have to be perfect. It has to work. Okay, without that, you are in extremely high risk. If you don't have a system, you're going to bring someone on board and they're going to figure out the system. Well, if this person is that good, they can take your business and figure out your system and run it and own it. They're not going to be here for you. They're going to have their own business already. You're not going to be able to hire that kind of person. They're out. They're not going to be here. So if you're going to bring someone on board, you have to have the basic infrastructure that's working already. It's profitable. You have an operations manager. You have a sales leader / manager, also maybe doing work, but also able to look at and lead. You have financial control. You have visibility. It works. You put this leader in place. They are able to optimize what works. They're not here to figure out what works. They're here to optimize what works. And then that's how you shift from an owner operator to a business owner. A business owner is the business can stand on its own two legs by itself. You don't have to be there. You're not needed at all. Okay? And then you shift into a capital allocator, which is the final stage.
Yeah, and I could see that being the when you're starting out in this venture of getting into construction, especially if you're wanting to be an entrepreneur, or wanting to get into start your own business here, and you've got to have some of the short term, the midterm, and these long term goals. The long term goal, I imagine, for most would be that business owner of being able to step away. Go take a trip in Europe for a month and come back and see if everything is still just running just fine. If it is, I suppose that could be an indication that, hey, maybe we've taken you to the step to the next level here. Maybe we're at a point where I could step away permanently.
So I've seen a lot of companies fail. I've seen a few companies get past this. There's a chasm. I call it, it's literally a chasm between 3 and 5 million. I've seen a lot of companies make money between 1 and 3 million. Nobody makes money between 3 and 5 million. Why? Why is this such a hard thing? I've seen my friend fail. I'm like, why? Because at that point, you know, you don't need those systems. You don't need the infrastructure. You don't need an operations manager between 1 and 3 million. It's not needed. You might need like a good project manager, a good salesperson. You don't need a financial controller. Maybe you do. You don't really need, but to go from 3 to 5 million, you're spending all of your profits on infrastructure, on the people, on getting the, you know, to go to the from 3 million to 10 million. Okay? That's, you're going to have to spend the money between 3 and 5 million. And then you start making money again at like 5, 6, 7 million. And at 10 million, you're making a lot of money because you have this infrastructure that's built that's now being distributed across many projects. So as you add incremental projects, you know, you don't need another financial controller. You don't need another operations manager. You don't need another office. Your overhead is the same at, call it, you know, 5-6 million as it is at, not exactly the same. You're going to need more project coordinators, designers, but I would say at least half of your overhead cost is set there. So you become much, much more profitable as actually you scale up your revenue, which is kind of counterintuitive. You would think you'd make less money, you make more money.
Hmm, that's really interesting. And so for you, what was it that indicated to you that you had crossed that threshold, crossed the chasm into business ownership? Was there a day, was there a moment like, wow, this just snapped, I see this?
I really wanted to move into technology, okay? I really wanted to get out of construction, because you gotta understand, I also just kind of stumbled in construction. It wasn't exactly the career that now, with all of my experience and hindsight, maybe I would have started there again, because frankly, it's awesome cash and tech is kind of boom bust situation. But it wasn't exactly what I had intended to start off with. I moved to tech. And I said, okay, I'm going to put my friend in. Frankly, it was mostly luck at my point. I had the infrastructure. It was. I'm only saying this out of hindsight, not because I had planned it and knew it. I didn't know it. I actually tried doing this in Toronto and it failed. I had the wrong leader in place and he wasn't able to operate the company well. Same in Calgary. I had the wrong incentive system in place. They had the systems. But again, I didn't have the right team in place and I wasn't around long enough to build the team there. Okay. That one failed. It worked in Vancouver because I did have the right team in place. Okay. And the right systems in place. And in Ottawa, I wasn't sure if it was going to work, frankly, but it did work. So it was only upon reflecting that I was able to look at why did it work? Oh, that's why it worked. I wasn't like sitting there thinking, well, if I do this, you know, I'm going to make it like self-operating and I'm going to be able to do all these things. No, it wasn't like that. It just happened that I had one of my best friends who also ran the Vancouver company who was able to step into the Ottawa company and wanted to do this. And I gave him like a lot of equity in the company as well because I knew that equity was a key in this business at least. It's a key thing for the business to operate on its own, is this one person needs to have a substantial amount of equity, and that's your main guy. He's going to be kind of you, essentially, in a way, okay? So you have to be very generous with your equity to that person. You could have other people who have equity, but they have a lot smaller amount. They also aren't as ambitious. You know, he wants to make $1 million a year, 300 grand at the time, $1 million now or more, like, you know, whatever it may be. So he wants that. The other guys are happy making 100K a year, 150, 200, 250 is awesome, right? You can't get someone to make a $20 million company who's trying to only make $250,000 a year as their ambition. It's just not really going to go very far, right? So he was like, I want to make this. And if I do this, I can get it there. And I've already created a $5 million company and it was all set up in place. So in hindsight, you know, for me, it was I didn't know for a few years. I'm like, I'm just happy that I'm making my salary, which was 150K. If I can make 150K and this runs itself, I'm good to go. You know, it wasn't until we really, you know, started picking up, and then, like, I always knew the model worked, right? But I had made some really big mistakes. And it kind of took away my confidence. But it was like kind of, it was actually slowing down, frankly, because I went too fast. and I burned too much capital. I made too many mistakes in that process, just growing super quickly. Slowing down was made it grow much more profitable, because it's like you make money and then you grow using some of that money. And you make money and then you grow. And then it's just like this step function, instead of just grow, almost like a tech company. It doesn't work in construction. You can't do this in construction. You can't grow like a tech company, okay? I don't recommend growing more than 40% year over year. If you do, you're going to be in a cash crunch. You're going to have some problems with people. You're putting your whole organization at risk at greater than 40%. In tech, anything less than 40%, and they're like, I don't know about that, right? Complete opposite here. And then there was like a point where it just all fits together, and like, you know, and it made sense because I had the leaders in place. I had the infrastructure in place. I had a wicked financial controller. I always recommend getting a good financial controller, definitely after 5 million. Most companies die because they're just really bad at cash management.
Yeah. Cash flow is, when I was starting my business, I had talked to, you know, as many small business owners as I could, just to get, you know, just milk them for information, just make sure that I was avoiding the mistakes they had made and try to, springboard as far forward here as I could. And it was amazing how much consistency there was in the advice they were given. Just about everybody told me two things. One is that your biggest stresses will be the cash flow, and your second biggest stress will be your managing people, you know, managing your employees. And those are probably where my biggest stresses come from, is managing the cash and managing the employees, making sure that the employees are staying happy enough that they're sticking around. You don't want to hunt a huge amount of turnover. You want to make sure that they're motivated to do a good job. You want to see, you want to have some ambition there so they can move up and take the responsibilities that you're doing so that you can free yourself up to do other projects you're more interested in, or grow the company, or do whatever needs to be done there. But just everything around the cash flow and managing employees for me has been the source of most of my stress as a small business owner. And consequently, the areas where I think a lot of care needs to be taken in order to manage that well.
Right now I have this Vancouver company I mentioned to you, and he was owner operator for a long time, and they hired a GM. Didn't give any equity. Okay. GM goes, takes over the company. My partner, or the owner of the company, moves back to Ottawa. So now he has a GM in Vancouver and he's in Ottawa, not in the same city. Flies back once in a while, checks in. This guy doesn't own any of the company. He's a GM. Okay. Doesn't understand cash flow statements. The company was doing 5 million and making 300-400K. Leaves to Ottawa, okay? No financial controller and no equity given to this individual. Within a year and a half, that company ends up losing $1 million. He has to fly back to Vancouver, fire that guy, step in, figure out the cash flow situation, okay? And deal with the show. Now I'm reminding the company of him because he made such a stupid mistake. And then now we're like looking for a good owner operator. And then I already have a wicked financial controller who can manage the numbers with a good owner operator who will be incentivized with equity. So you're right. It's the people, and the cash flow management is the highest risk things in construction.
Yeah. So much stress in there. Well, and Mo, we're pretty well out of time here. Really interesting conversation. Really interesting hearing about just your wealth of experience there in construction, and really just then in sales, and your whole background there is very, very interesting, and a lot of valuable information there for anybody who's new in the construction industry. So if you're into construction, if you're into sales, if you're into entrepreneurship, you really need to be following Mo on LinkedIn. Mo, how should anybody contact you if they want to pick your brain on some things like this? Is LinkedIn maybe the best source here, or something else?
LinkedIn's good. I like Instagram myself. I post a lot more of like my daily life on Instagram. LinkedIn's, you know, it's groomed for what it is. It's mostly like a resume. But so Instagram at Real Mo Abbas, real, and then MOEABBAS. And I want to just tell everyone, look, you know, the new wave right now is AI. It's going to change the world. They're saying it's going to be bigger than the internet. Okay, it's going to radically increase GDP. And if you're not using AI in your company, you're going to be at a tremendous disadvantage. We have a solution, salesask.com. It's AI for your sales team. Okay, it's going to help you. It's going to be a game changer for you. Go online, check it out, book a demo. I'd be happy to talk with you. And I'd be happy just to share how you could use AI in your company, because it's like, I was there. I've been in that position. I used the early technologies to build what is now a $20 million company. And without that first mover advantage, frankly, I wouldn't be here. I'd just be another guy making a couple million dollars like everybody else, right? So check out salesask.com, book a demo, and let's figure out how to help you get to that next level.
That's fantastic. Mo, maybe we can have you onto the show another time in the future. We didn't even get to jujitsu or Wim Hof or any other cool stuff that goes on behind the scenes. So we'll need to touch on that at some other point. But Mo, thank you so much for being on here with us at the Concrete Conversations podcast, and maybe we'll have to do this sometime soon.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much, Forrest.
Thank you.